For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. That's right. For the record, you ain't trying to grow, then it's done for you. That's right. For the record, lab on me going all the way. All the way. For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste. Stop calling. For the record, for the record, for the record, for the record, for the record. For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable.
Hey, here we are back again for another amazing episode on season 4 dedicated to amazing and inspiring women with stories of redemption. Look, I just want to say a massive thank you to everybody out there who's continuing to support and follow The Clink. The downloads have been phenomenal. Remember to subscribe, rate and comment. It helps us to be able to grow and get our stories out there. Tonight, once again, off the back of some amazing stories already in season 4 of Inspiring Women, I have a wonderful lady with a great story. Sandy, Jessamine, welcome to The Clink.
Thank you, Brent.
How are you? You look a bit nervous. You all right?
Oh, I'm just flooey.
A bit flooey. I can. You're all rugged up there. And you've gotten through this period of COVID unscathed, though?
Oh, look, I'm a writer, so if someone says stay at home,
it's like, yes.
Don't go anywhere and socialise. Stay away from the grandkids. Sorry, grandkids, for a little while.
You enjoy your writing?
My book is called Borderline. For a number of reasons. One was I worked as a prison teacher, and in 2014 I was working in a protection prison where there were child sex offenders and police. But yeah, it coincided with a bit of a family tragedy. My daughter had relapsed on drugs, and I had a mental breakdown inside the prison. Okay. And it ended a 15-year career working in education and drug and alcohol, because I literally flipped out. And do you know what dissociation is?
Yeah, I do, actually. And Wilma Robb, a wonderful lady who we had on here the last start of the season 4, was explaining exactly that. And she lives with disassociation.
Yeah. So what, well, it's different for a lot of people. For some people, the world you're in becomes a ghost world. Like, you look around and the furniture's all creepy and wraith-like, and people, you can almost see through people. So in 2014, I was a teacher in a Sydney men's protection prison that held corrupt cops in custody, child sex offenders, crown witnesses, et cetera, et cetera. I'd worked in the prison system for about 14 years, and I was used to working at the Bay, Parkley, Silverwater, all over the place.
This sounds like the Supergrass unit at Long Bay. That's what it sounds like. Next to Long Bay. No, I know you can't, but that's the only place they put crown witnesses, child offenders and corrupt coppers. Supergrass unit. I got you.
No clues. But yeah, my daughter relapsed on drugs, and she'd been really well, and it was heartbreaking. It was ice, and my dad was dying of cancer, and I was fighting with a prison boss, and I had this dissociative mental breakdown. For me, trauma dissociation, three different things happen. The environment ceases to exist. It becomes a ghost land, a wasteland. I am no longer in my body. My limbs float around me. I fade in and out of time. And the other part is I split. So what happened in this bloody prison is I went through amnesic phases where child states took over, from little girl child states. And, you know, I was dancing with the inmates and hugging them and walking through mud and doing all this really weird stuff. But I was very isolated. There were no managers, no custodial officers around. A small group of inmates knew I was literally flipping out and switching personalities, but it took a while for the prison managers to discover this. Yeah, so when they finally worked out that I was losing it during a family crisis, I was moved to the main jail. I was literally escorted out by two officers, moved to the main jail, sat in a back office for 2 months. Well, I'm off the track, but I remember during that phase, I used to prowl the inmate library looking for novels to read. And this guy says
prowl the inmate library.
It was, getting books. And he said, what is it you do here? And I said, I read books. Isn't it obvious? And he said, do you get paid for that? Which, of course, I did. But I got very bored, and the guys found out I taught creative writing, and I sort of came back into my body and started teaching again. Late 2014, my father died of cancer, and I began to recall what happened in the protection prison. And I'm going, this can't be right. Like, it was almost like I was recalling things I hadn't consciously experienced. It was, I'd see myself doing something and I'd go, but I have no memory about that. And my therapist took me through hypnosis, and the full welt of the breakdown came. And I ended up telling my prison bosses about it. And I already had a long history of complex post-traumatic stress disorder and dissociation, but he diagnosed borderline personality disorder, and I was forced to resign from my job.
Can I just ask you something there? So, I really want to go back before you started working in this job, because I think it's very important for our listeners to understand and know who you were before you become this amazing, wonderful woman that did so much to help others. You didn't always work on the right side of the wall, did you?
No. Well, after I lost my job, I went back to, I had to go to heal myself. I had to go back to a juvenile institution I was locked in the 70s.
That's right.
I had an identical breakdown there.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about that experience of what it was like coming through that journey in the 70s and where it led to. I mean, I think that's very important for our listeners out there to understand who Sandy Jesmine is in reference to what your history is to why you're on the clink.
So if I go back to the beginning, I was adopted at birth. So I said adopted in, born in 59, adopted to a couple who were told they couldn't have children, who promptly had 3 pregnancies in the next 3 years. So there was a stack of us under 4. I was the only adopted child. It was an Air Force family, so we moved around a lot. I only finished 1 year of high school, but by then I'd been to 7 different schools, 1 year and 1 term of second form back then. So we moved a lot. You know, Dad, a bit of a heavy drinker.
Yeah.
And I had all sorts of behavioural problems. First psychiatrist I was sent to was 7. We just moved to Adelaide. And I was frightened they were going to abandon me. And between the age of 3 and 5, I had an uncle tamper with me. He didn't rape me, but...
Inappropriate touchings and stuff like that.
Inappropriate touching that I blocked out for most of my life. But the threat was, you're the adopted kid. They've got their own. They don't want you. And so I guess when you're a really little girl, you know, I was terrified. You know, he basically told me I was going to be taken to a hospital and tied up and jabbed with needles and never let out of bed. So my grandmother rescued me from that situation. They didn't really know what was happening. They just knew that 5-year-olds don't start shoplifting and putting lollies in their
hands. No, you're rebelling.
Things. Yeah, so I was rebelling. So
my grandmother, can I say, reaching out for attention because something wasn't right.
Yeah, well, more distressed, and a little kid's distressed, it comes out in all sorts of ways. So anyway, she took me, I was fine. Then I went back to my family and it stopped. So nothing, this was very young, 5, went back, 6 was good. Dad was a bit of a heavy drinker, and some wise person, doctor said, go back in the Air Force where he'd been before and it'll cure your drinking. Now, I've never heard of anyone joining the Air Force, Army or Navy to cure a drinking problem. So anyway, we moved to Adelaide. And somehow that's when I really began to have behavioural problems at that time. I think flashbacks for a little girl of seven of something that doesn't make sense or has no language.
Yep.
So I shunted off to a psychiatrist who thought there was absolutely nothing wrong with me. And somehow we'd moved. I made a friend, a little Aboriginal girl, and it made all the difference, you know, just moving to this place and having this really good friend. So I was fine. And then we moved again to Sydney.
Yep.
And around the age of 12, I was almost raped by a boy. You know, I managed to get away, and so it didn't happen. But he told, I just started high school, he told a lot of his friends that it had. So suddenly at 12, I had all these boys pinning me to walls and really horrible stuff happening. And at that time, I was 12, I'd started high school. I was in the swimming club, a great swimmer, trained every morning, 66 laps. I was put in the top class. It was Windsor High School on the outskirts of Sydney. I was in 1A.
Did you find that therapeutic, though, for your way of life and the things that were going on? Was it like a release to be able to go there and exert yourself and, you know?
The swimming?
Yeah.
No, not at the time, because one of the girls in the swimming club, it was her brother who who tried to rape me. So I was glad it was over.
Yep.
But I ran away from home. I was 13, didn't only gone for a few hours with a friend.
Yep.
Sent to my grandmother's again, who, So I think my family, this one's trouble, send it to the grandmother's. And so for a while, things were really good. But my family moved to Wagga in the interim.
Yep.
And I had this, you have turning points in your life where there's a fork in the road and it can go in either direction. So my grandmother and my great uncle wanted to actually put me in a private school at that, you know, they were farm people, had a bit of money, put me in Gippsland Grammar.
Yeah.
And my parents moved to Wagga and Mum said, why don't you come home? It's a fresh start. And school holidays had started, so I wasn't seeing my schoolmates on the farm. And I went home to Wagga. And as so often happened in my life, I made a friend, a really good friend, and decided to stay. But within weeks, we were wagging school and I started a shoplift, fighting with the parents.
Yeah.
And we ran away together. So I just turned 14. We ran away. We slept in this really old railway shed and it was freezing. It was right
was,
at the end.
Was this still 30. In Wagga as well?
No. By then, I think I was in the shed. I've got it on my records, but it was Cootamundra, Tamora, something. But
no, Cootamundra,
it was an old
yeah.
shed, freezing cold, end of May. We were under a tarp, thought rats were clean under us. And we found this old chest, in the corner. And we thought, oh, great, there's checks in it.
Yeah,
railway
yeah.
checks, probably 50 years old. And so we, being, you know, really not too smart, I think, we went to the bank and tried to cash these railway checks.
Railway checks, yeah? And this is yeah, this was, is in the 60s for, or the early this 60s, late 60s?
No, this is 73 by then.
In 73, yeah, okay.
Yeah, I think one was for about 1 cent. About $30.
Wow.
I know. So anyway, I had a I'd shoplifted before and being caught. So I was thrown into, I was sentenced to an institution for theft at the age of 14.
It was, if I can just cut in there, in reference to what you just said there, which I think is really relevant. You know, I've been very blessed to have some amazing, inspiring women like yourself on the clink. And it seemed to be that you didn't have to do much in that era. You know, like, once again, I just touched base on Wilma Robb, an amazing woman, which I believe that you know her.
I'm friends with
her. I just absolutely adore her. She's just amazing. But she made it very clear that she didn't have a criminal record, you know, and you didn't have to do much. She was just troublesome, if I can put it in that way. And it sounds very similar in your sort of way. Yes, you were caught, you know, shoplifting and then had the checks, but you're just a young girl, just doing your best. Yeah. You're not out there really committing crimes as such, are you?
Well, no, I stole a baseball cap and I was put on 12 months probation.
Yeah,
I'd wag school, stolen a baseball cap. And yeah, it was such a trivial thing. And even the second time, it was really, you know, it was really trivial. But
what were your parents like about it, though? Or was it more that they'd brushed their hands by this stage? Because there was a lot of young, well, we're talking about women, but men and women that were state wards because they were uncontrollable or not able to not run away or do what they were told at school, wasn't it?
At that point, they hadn't wiped their hands of me. You know, I went back to them in the January.
Yeah.
I started getting in trouble in March, you know, and the welfare officer was called in. And in my welfare records, he basically said my problem was a need to grow up and conform to family and community standards.
Of course. Don't worry about underlying problems. It's all your problem. Terrible so young lady.
That was his view. Mm. So I was pretty shocked when I wound up in Minda.
Yep, been there.
14 and 2 months. So, because in some ways I'd experienced this sexual abuse, but in some ways I'd been very sheltered in this family. It was the responsible drinking. You know, Dad was a sergeant in the Air Force. Mum was a nurse, you know, or nursing sister, they'd called it. So, you know, so in a lot of ways I've been sheltered from things like poverty and definitely no street culture. So I wind up in Minda, and by then my name was Sandra as a kid, but after the boys, that boy tried to rape me and I went to my grandparents, I changed it to Sandy just automatically. I didn't want Sandra to exist anymore.
Were these your adoptive grandparents or your blood grandparents, Annie?
Adoptive, yeah. My mum's mum and her brother.
Okay.
So it was great uncle.
Yep.
So, you know, if I'd have stayed with them, like I said, fork in the road, go to she called the girls' homes reform schools. So instead of winding up in a private school, I wound up in reform school. Mm. So the first thing when you get to Minda, they take you to the clinic and they give you a physical examination to check if you're pregnant or have venereal disease. So I was still a virgin. I still have my certificate from 1973 saying I don't have venereal disease.
Really? I mean, look, once again, I went through Minda and that. And I'm 45, definitely not, you know, a 70 models when I was in there. I was late 80s, early 90s. But, you know, you were bathed in solutions and stuff to, you know, for scabies and body wraps and crabs, I suppose, for males. And they did the same for, and what, they had to give you a certificate to basically acknowledge that you had no STDs, I guess, as well. Is that what we're talking about?
Oh, no, they didn't give me a certificate. So what happened with young girls when they were put in custody?
Yeah.
They checked for pregnancy and venereal disease. So they gave you an internal examination, basically. So to me, it was quite horrific, you know.
Was it forced or was it something that was compulsory or could you say no to it?
No, you couldn't say no. I remember I tried to, and we'll get someone to hold your legs open.
Yeah, wow.
So, I mean, most women I've spoken to talk about it.
Yeah.
So this went on my welfare records, which I got years later. I went, oh, there it is, clear of venereal disease.
Yeah.
So from, I guess for me at Minda, I was really, I was sheltered and I was seen as quite sheltered. I mean, there were a lot of girls like me back in that era. If a young girl gets raped, what happens is she's charged with exposed to moral danger and she's thrown in an institution and often nothing happens to the boy.
This is something I think we should talk a little bit more about for our listeners here, because that just sounds absolutely absurd. A young woman is raped, but then she's the one charged because of the rape that occurred to her, which then she's locked up for. So not only is someone totally just stripped her of all innocence, but then they take away everything she's got by locking her up.
Yeah, it was.
I'm sorry, I'm just trying to process that. I mean, that's, wow. Sorry, yeah.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, others uncontrolled, well, later on, I'll get to there later because I was locked up more than once, but others were in for uncontrollable. And back then it could be quite trivial. You know, they'd wag school.
Yeah.
You know, they'd cheat their parents or they'd run away from home. So basically the institutions were a mishmash of, here's the 13, sometimes 12-year-old girl who's cheeked her parents and wags school.
Yeah.
Minda, here's the 17-year-old girl who has committed an armed robbery, working, you know, at the cross at the time.
Yep.
And other girls in for violent offences. So we're all thrown together in Minda from about 11 to 17.
Wow.
And for me, it was just a massive culture shock. I think what saved me, back in those days, we all used to, you know, the girls used to send each other love letters. Mm. I love, worship and adore, or I love, worship always. And I guess when I went to Minda, a couple of girls befriended me, and this pretty little girl, long blonde hair, I remember her, about 14, you know, like really, you became lovers but not sexual lovers. It was the whole
just
thing
more hand, compassionate and caring for each other.
Friends. Yeah. So I was pretty lucky at first that I formed some friendships.
Yeah.
I was sent to Ormond.
Yep.
I was 14.
Another terrible place with atrocities that have happened over the years in abuse.
Yeah, I didn't experience that there. I sort of was quite shy at first, which when I go into what happened later seems amazing. Quite shy, well-behaved, until when I was getting out, I'd been planning to go and live with my grandmother, you know. And my great-uncle had a heart attack. And the welfare officer visited me and said, well, sorry, you've got to go back to your parents. And I went, well, you know, stuff you. I'll get there myself. And I tried to get over the Minda wall. I'm in the Ormond wall with another girl. And so for the first time, I got thrown in this isolation cell, and it was cold and it was winter, and I get claustrophobia.
Yeah.
Anything to do with being trapped, confined, and almost panic attacks. So I was thrown in there, and I got out, and I was sent to Reby, which had just
I know Reby, just out at Ed's.
Yeah.
Funny enough, and it's, you know, it's so ironic because I hear and listen to so many stories in the clink, you know, we're four seasons deep, and so many people talk about Reby. You know, I remember as a kid, I grew up in the housing commission there at Ed's, so it was an Aboriginal basically mission. You know what I mean? It was I was a white fella in the black fella's community, and I do remember playing up and rebelling. You know, that 10 years of age, I was being sexually abused, and I was rebelling. And you know, I was always taken to the front gates of Reby. I'll drop you off here, and you'll go in here. This is where you'll go. This is where you'll stay. And it wasn't until all the years of jail and boys' home that I did, from, you know, 13 years onwards, I sort of sat back and thought, "Fuck, did you put the curse on me or what?" You know what I mean?
What a threat.
Like, and it was, but I think back in those days, you know, you'll behave or that's where you'll end up. You know what I mean? Or, you know, it was like the leather strap and the wooden spoon. It was nothing to cop that, or the big clip under the ear. That's just how it was, wasn't it?
Oh, that was normal. The same here. You'll be thrown into, oh, my family was so funny. You'll be thrown into reform school. They were Presbyterians.
Oh,
so
bless
they
them.
Had this thing about Catholics.
Yes.
God, later I married. So they would go, you'll either be thrown into a convent or reform school. And to them, they were as bad. One was as bad as the other.
That's right.
Apparently they were when you hear the sexual abuse.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, but anyway, I was sent to Reby, and suddenly I was 14.
Yeah.
And, you know, the girl, one of the very youngest girls at Reby, I was in with the older girls. And Reby had just opened. They, at that time, it was going to replace Parramatta Girls' Home, which was closing down. So girls from Ormond were sent to Reby, and girls from Parramatta Girls' Home. So at first, half the beds were empty. It was a funny feeling there because it was brand new bricks and our clothes were brand new. No, which I was used to, secondhand cottontail knickers that went to the knees and 20 other girls had worn before you. Everything was new and it smelt new. It was this, you know, when you go to a place that is uninhabited and there's just, you walk through and it feels quite hollow.
Yep, it's very eerie. Mm.
So Rebe, things went downhill drastically. At that time, I was small, long blonde hair in plaits. I don't know. I never saw myself as middle class. My family lived in Air Force housing, but to a lot of the girls there, I'd come from a different world.
Yeah.
So not long after arriving, someone hit me. Well,
as in physically hit you.
Physically hit me.
Yeah.
But I have a bit of a wildcat in me. Like I often switch personalities. So someone hitting me is, so the next thing I'm clawing at her hair and face and screaming. She quite liked me after that. Oh, you know, this is, you know, like it was really a bizarre thing. But from that moment on, I was in trouble at Rebe. Once Wildcat came out, Wildcat ran amok. Part of me would be going, no, no, no. You know, I was in the typing class. I was in the sewing class trying to behave and she was smashing windows and trying to jump over walls. And at one point, we had a riot. All the girls jumped in the pool closed. And if you read my records, it's quite comical. We all threw talcum powder around the dormitory and sat with arms linked. And the superintendent complained that we seemed to be enjoying ourselves. And so at that point, I was seeing a psychiatrist. They didn't know what to do with me because I was in the typing class doing really well. So on the one hand, I was sort of this really well-behaved, quite sweet girl. And on the other hand, I'm yelling and swearing and carrying on. So my records show I was being considered for Hay, even though I was only 14. The Hay. If she doesn't improve, she's going to Hay. And I know this in retrospect. The next record says, well, she really is a devious, cunning girl because she's been on her best behaviour trying to get release.
Yeah.
So instead,
can I just ask you too, Sandy, when you talk of Hay, I mean, obviously, once again, having, you know, learnt a lot from some of your amazing women, and I've been blessed to have the conversations with women who have lived life like yourself, you know what I mean? And I don't mean that in any way disrespectful, but not younger women, you know what I mean? And we're talking about women that have truly gone through some bad shit. The Hay School was known to be an absolutely horrible, horrible place. And did you find that the moment you would find out that you could possibly be going to Hay, that it changed your mindset, or was it something that didn't bother you?
I didn't have a clue. I read this in my records later. After one of our riots where one girl got on the roof and we all jumped in the pool, and it was a girl, you know, we had girl crushes on each other. So it was someone I'd sent a love letter to who'd responded. So this girl and I had just clicked up and we jumped in the shower and soaped each other. And
and you said it was non-sexual.
Well, it was. It wasn't sexual. We were just, anyway, when we got out of
it was
the shower,
fun.
We're thrown in separate isolation cells. It was just, you know.
I understand.
It was girls. She was in, and they came for her at around 4 in the morning. I was 14. She was a couple of years older, and I got out and the girl said she'd actually gone to Hay from Rebe. I don't know that definitely. She could have gone to Parramatta Girls Home, but it was really odd them getting her at 4 in the morning.
Was it, Sandy, was it that predominant sort of era was basically it was either Parramatta Girls, Hay, which was the worst place you could possibly end up, Rebe and Minda. Were they the sort of four, you know, I know Ormond was there, but was that the four sort of strong youth detention centres or juvenile justice centres, as we call them, I guess, today, for women?
No. Minda and Glebe Shelter were remand centres.
Okay.
Ormond was for younger girls, 12 to 14.
Was that more state wards as well?
It was just anyone.
Anyone
who was young. Really, Reby was replacing Parramatta Girls Home, so there was an overlap. So technically, instead of being sent to Parramatta Girls Home in the closing stage, girls were now sent to Reby. Hay was what we were all threatened with. You know, muck up and you'll go to Hay. And we all knew what they went through there because girls who came back told us how.
So there was definite conversations between you young women. What went on at Hay and how bad it was out there?
Oh, gosh, yeah. I knew girls who'd been through Hay in Minda and later on. So we knew how horrific it was and no one wanted to go there. So I didn't know they were even considering me, but because I could fluctuate from really being out of control to being really, really good, I was sent home, which was a nightmare anyway.
Was it a nightmare or a little bit of a positive on your side of being able to play both sides to your wanting, if you know what I mean? Like if you're playing up too much, you could pull your head in sort of thing and go, nah, I'm going to get my shit together, or it became an issue?
No, it's totally different. Because I split and have bouts of amnesia, I sometimes don't remember what I did. And
even back then?
Even back then.
Wow.
So I remember a district officer, from Little Child.
Okay.
I was reading recently in one of my welfare reports, and he'd written in it, Sandy was the ringleader in one of, you know, this jack-up in the dormitory. However, when I spoke to her, she completely denied it. Only this time she was really friendly and communicative. So they probably just thought I was a compulsive liar, but literally sometimes when I'm in one state, I have no access to the others. And so that's why back then the psychiatrist was really confused, because they put, oh, well, she can behave if she wants to.
Yeah.
But sometimes it wasn't sort of, I didn't have a lot of control over it.
Yeah.
And I think it became apparent when I was sent back home to my family.
Was there things, though, that, Sandy, you found that triggered that? Like, for me, I live with type 2 bipolar, and I've only over the, you know, it's been, crikey, 30-odd years. But, I mean, not that they knew what bipolar was. I was everything else but bipolar. And then when they realised what bipolar was, it was diagnosed as bipolar, type 2. But I understand now, after educating myself, that there are certain trigger points and I can feel episodes coming on. Was there certain things that you, okay, so that you then could sort of prepare yourself, or just it was like, hang the, I'm off. Like, I don't know where I'm going or how long this is going to last, but I'm going.
I was 14 first time at Reby.
Yep.
I was released the day after I turned 15. So literally, it was more a switch. Sometimes what could trigger it sometimes was feeling alienated or like I didn't belong or not part of the group. But that didn't happen during my first stint in custody. I was one of the girls.
Yes.
Happened later. Oh, my gosh. But I think it was, you know, you're in this, Reby was just like Parramatta, but it looked much nicer, and they were trying to bring in some progressive things like jazz ballet and that. But I spent my time in isolation cells and scrubbing, and I think it was just, I have this terror of being confined and trapped. So when it began to close in, I'd explode. And I also knew I couldn't go to my grandmother's. That's why I'd escaped from Ormond. So I knew, you know, I was still 14. I knew I had to go back to this family where I was always, that triggered a lot of trauma-related dissociation.
Absolutely.
Where I was the outsider, the misfit.
Never actually accepted. One. Yeah.
Yeah, they tried. And, you know, they had kind sides. They just didn't know how to cope with me. So they weren't technically bad people. You know, they could be very kind, but I was always the misfit, the outsider. And it was often linked to being adopted, or you've got bad blood, bad genes, you know. So it was never linked to the fact that my father was a heavy drinker or a lot of everything was respectable on the surface.
That's pretty shit, but Sandy, when you already know, like, when did you find out you were adopted? What age?
Oh, I always knew. Okay. Probably about 3 years old.
So I can't remember. You knew that life was going to be different for you no matter which way you went. You were always going to have some sort of detachment feeling or feeling of never being, you know, everything to that family, so to speak. Yet you're being put down and belittled because you're adopted.
Well, I think it began at seven. I mean, my memories of then, I had this grandmother who was, like I said, she was really my ally, very stoic woman. You know, she just liked me and stood by me. So I'd get sent to her. But I think when I was seven and began to have all these behavioural problems, and I mean, this is like setting fire to my sister's bed. She wasn't in it. Yeah. Flooding the house, you know, the washing machine, all of these really, they just went, well, what is this? You know, so the other kids didn't act like I did. So I think at seven, that's when it became a real issue that I was adopted and I was different. But at seven, that's your family. That's where you do belong. So, and you know, they could be very kind. And yeah, my mother was always pretty, you know, she kept the house together.
Yeah.
So, and I was quite attached to her. So, but yeah, that theme, whenever I was in trouble, I was the outsider. There was something wrong with my brain.
Yeah, you weren't like us.
Bad blood.
Weren't like us. You're different.
Well, I wasn't like them. No. Yes.
Which to me, you know, is very traumatic for a young girl, young boy or girl, but, you know, specifically speaking about you and your journey. That right there seeds some terrible trauma ahead. You know, like I just said to you before about me, you know, being put at the front of a juvenile justice centre at, you know, very young age and embedded into my head, this is where you're going to end up. You're going to be in here. I'm going to drop you off here if you don't behave.
Yeah.
Like, you instantly start to think to yourself, well, you know, I'm shit. I'm unloved. I'm unwanted. I don't want to be here. Why do I want to be put in that situation and be told this? You know, we learned today, I guess, through, well, a progression, I guess, in medicine and all the wonderful things that people learn today, that, you know, trauma comes in so many different ways. But yes. Verbate trauma, verbate abuse is one of the worst. I mean, we can all be smacked, and I've been smacked, you've been smacked, it was just how it was, that's how it grew up. You got the spoon, the belt, whatever, like we said before. Today, don't touch your kids. I've got four children, and God forbid if I ever smacked one of their bottoms. I haven't, and I wouldn't. For me, it's a flick on the ear. You know, that's as far as it goes. But, you know, it was something that you dealt with, and you sort of moved forward from it. You copped a smack on the ass. Woohoo. But if you had a parent putting you down and constantly, like, I can remember things my mother said and did to me as a child that I just, at 45, it haunts me, you know, like things like that. It's not good.
Well, more, I think it's the intermittent reinforcement, like all us kids with my father, because, you know, he's a heavy drinker. He liked to go out after work to the pub and play cards, and he was right into the Air Force culture. So for us, when he, you know, there were wonderful times when he'd sit us all around him. He'd be on this, we'd be on the floor and he'd be playing his mouth organ and we'd all be singing The Wild Colonial Boy, and he'd make us pancakes. So what happened with Dad was we really got this attention, intermittent reinforcement, and then he'd retreat and we wouldn't see him and he'd ignore us or he'd be strapping us. It was the era, you wait till your father gets home.
Yep.
So he'd walk in from the pub, this one, and give us a good strap. And
yep.
It was a real, whereas my mother was sort of there, you know, she was quite a kind person, but she was tired. She had all these little kids.
Yeah, and later especially so close together.
So it was quite a strange environment to be in. It was almost like at a young age I realized two things. One was the reality of what is happening is not what's spoken about.
Yep.
So there was this confusion that in this house, all of this happens, but it's not spoken. And the other thing, I was about nine, I thought, no one knows what I'm thinking in my head. There's a whole other world in there and a lot of voices of different girls who exist in me. So yeah. The me I am, it didn't help that I'd lose time, chunks of it. And the me on the surface is not the same. So it was a really...
Did that scare you at all, living with that mindset? Did it ever... You know what I mean, Sandy? Do you ever used to sit down and before you could understand what it was that you were truly living with, did it haunt you and you know, constantly make you question life?
It did, even as a little child, because I was an enigma back then. I can remember getting straight A's in primary school, but being the kid who out of the blue would jump on the table and start dancing or screaming.
Yeah.
I remember I was in about year 4 or 5, and as punishment, they put me back to grade one and made me sit in this tiny little chair with all these little kids about me. So I had no idea why one minute I could be writing this lovely poetry and the next I could be ripping my room to bits and screaming hysterically and flailing.
So do you think back then around. The easiest solution is problem child?
You got issues. Definitely.
You got issues because, you know, we're only in the last 20 years we've started to see duty of care and compassion be shown within these sort of environments in reference to awareness and education around mental health, mental illnesses, you know, sicknesses in general, which is what you were living with. You know, it was an illness.
My mother thought, she told the psychiatrist, she said, look, she's got a split personality. And as an adult, she said, you could be this sweet little girl. And she said, then basically you were a raging little bitch. She used that word. She said, you're attacking everyone.
This is the clink. Say what you want.
At 8, I ran away from home.
Yeah.
And she said it was just exhausting. So I've sort of got off track there. I'm not sure what we were talking about.
No, you're not off track. This is your journey, and this is the beautiful thing is, you know, you're giving our listeners out there a true unedited story of your life and your story of redemption. I think it's all very relevant, Sandy, to, you know, where it takes us later in our chat. You know, so now understanding a little bit about you and your background and what you were living with and what you were trying to, I guess, deal with on a daily basis within yourself. You said that you spent a couple of times or a few times locked up as well.
Yes.
So after Rebe, where did you go from Rebe again?
Okay, that's when I had, day after my 15th birthday, I went home to Wagga to my family. And a lot of young people who are locked up experienced it. I tried to work at Woolies and I just even felt strange after. I was locked up for 10 months, you know, because of my behaviour. Even I tried to study at TAFE and I couldn't relate to the girls, had boyfriends and makeup and normal lives,
yeah,
and couldn't be around. And even being in Woolworths packing shelves, I felt like an alien.
Yeah.
I walked around my house and it was literally like haunting the wrong house. I just, you know, I didn't go back to school because everyone knew I'd been locked up.
Yeah.
And so I was just 15. And
well, this is in a time too where you'd be just cleanly a criminal, untrusted. Yeah. No one want to associate with you. You're just scum. You're written off how society would have seen you, isn't it? You're just an absolute... You're out of here. We don't want nothing to do with you.
I'd been locked in this girl's home. We were in Wagga. I'd been there a few months before I was locked up, so hardly knew anyone. I hadn't grown up there. So I went back to this strange place, a family that felt strange in this strange town. Now, there was a girl who'd been in the home, but she was a couple of years older and had brothers who'd been in jail, and I was literally still, you know, that frightened me, so I didn't go near her. I met this army guy who took me out, and it was a pretty horrible experience. He was out at Kapuka, and I was just, you know, he nearly ran over the dog. I was throwing balls in the front yard, and the dog ran out. But I got to know him, And he, I didn't know how he perceived me. I just thought, oh, this boy likes me.
How old was he?
He was in Kapuka. He was about 19 or 20.
And you were 17, were you? 16, 17?
No, I just turned 15.
Oh, shit. Okay.
I just turned 15. Yeah, so right. I wasn't
You were still
17.
Quite young.
That was way, way.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he thought, I didn't know, he thought this girl's been locked in institutions. She's a bit of a tramp, not a virgin.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you. Yeah.
Was. So, you know, he took me out and he said, come on, you know, come to, my mates are all got a hotel room. Do you want to, you know, come? And I went, oh, yeah, yeah, because I wasn't thinking anything.
Yeah.
Anyway, the boy ended up having sex with me. They feeding Uzo into me, you know. I just, at the time, afterwards, blood everywhere, he realised I was a virgin. And he went, oh, fuck, you know. It was actually a revolting treatment of young girls. He went, oh, fuck, if we all go through her and she screams rape, we're done for.
Oh, my God.
He said, why didn't you tell me you're a virgin? And I was, you know. I was sort of spinning. Anyway, put me on the back of his motorbike and he dropped me off at the corner. You say anything, you'll be back in that home. It triggered all the younger abuse. And I, even talking about it, but this was, young girls were seen as either sluts or, it was a horrific time for girls. Yeah, sluts,
terrible, terrible era, wasn't it?
Boys treated them. So I triggered mass trauma. I went back inside. I still remember going into my room and I'm reliving sexual assault from when I was little. And I've got no idea why I'm splitting all over the place. So what happened? I got every single pill in the house. I still remember it. I decided the best thing I could do was die. And I just remember being violently ill and being taken to hospital and charcoal and having, you know, and my family hadn't a clue what had happened. So it was the start of a horror 3 months being out, because it was just such a degrading, debasing experience. And to actually, you know, that someone I thought liked me and to actually be treated that way. So
I think too, Sandy, like knowing that, you know, all you probably wanted was to be loved, you know, just pay attention to you and give you a connection, you know, that warm feeling that you've got someone to support, someone you trust, someone.
Well, no, I was just very lonely. You know, my mum worked as a nurse. Father was sergeant out in the Air Force. Yep. And I was, my brothers and sister were at school. I was home alone. I had no friends. So it began a time of trying to kill myself. You know, I tried. I've still got the scar, you know, slashing the wrist. I still got a scar here where I put a needle on my left hand, right, a full needle in my arm, hoping it would travel up and kill me. Girls in the homes did it so they could hit a vein. So I was splitting. I was just, my parents were a total witch. End. I was screaming, smashing the place. I was just, I'd gone into trauma. The psychiatrist at the local hospital, I think he triggered, I had dissociation, because mum said, look, when she comes out of it, her eyes are blinking and it's like she comes back from being in another world. He gave me Meloril. Well, I hated it. It was, you know, well, I didn't get into drugs or alcohol, got really drunk on dad's beer only once, spewed it up. But Meloril was just like that horrible feeling when you can't wait to go to the toilet and wrap your arms around it.
The bowl, the porcelain bowl.
So here I was, actively suicidal. And what happened one day, I was in my room. I decided I was going to pull myself out of it, got a job in a pie kitchen, was going to a nursing home, helping mum feed the oldies. You know, I've got to come out of that, but I was flipping. So one day I'm having a smoke in my bedroom,
yeah,
you know, I remember the Marlboros.
Not the old Marlboro Red.
The old Marlboros.
Oh, my God. I grew up stealing them from my old man's packet when I was about 11. Oh, 16 milligram fucking Marlboro Red. I thought I was the coolest kid because I can handle it and not cough. Between them and Crave and A.
What I did, I started flicking matches. And I set fire to my bra. Later, I'd think I was a feminist, well ahead of time. So I remember I just threw all the clothes on the floor, was flicking matches, set the bra, and tiny little fire. Anyway, Dad, first time he ever punched me, actually, came, I don't know what happened in the interim, but he came in. I remember him punching me, stomping it out, throwing an ashtray. Somehow in the middle of this fit, the local welfare officer arrived at my house, walked into my bedroom, and Mum was saying, I can't deal with it. She's right, trying to kill herself. And he basically said, we need to go to court to resolve this.
So you once again were classed as completely out of control.
Well, he said, we'll find you a hostel to live. It's clear you can't live with your family. So went to court, charged with uncontrollable. I was put back in Minda, and they... 3 weeks had psych assessments and things, and they were looking for a hostel to me. Went back to court and they said, oh, we can't find any, you're sentenced for uncontrollable. So here I was back in Reby, which to me was the bizarrest. Who throws a suicidal 15-year-old in an institution because you can't find her somewhere else to live? So it was just so that time I had a lot of resentment about being locked up.
Yeah.
And ironically, I snapped out of it when I went back, because here were these friends, here were these other girls who'd gone back to the very places they'd run away from, only to find things were worse, and they were back in. And it was,
Can I just ask you something? Because I know, growing up in that sort of environment myself, I've always... living on the streets and not having that family support, I didn't really ever mind going back to Yasma or Minda or, Cobham, Penang, wherever I was sent. There was always someone you knew from another sentence or someone from the street or outside. It's almost became like a family. You sort of went back there and you were, okay, there was problems. We both know that that's just incarceration. It doesn't matter where you go, boys' homes, jail, girls' homes, there's always tension. But... the point is that it sort of felt like it was okay to be there. It was home, friends. It was just all right.
In a way, yes. Like the first time I was put in Minda, I was a naive young girl with long blonde plaits and, and very innocent in that. I mean, second time I was back, I still had basically done nothing but scream in my room and try to kill myself. So I wasn't streetwise, but the second time I went back, I was a return offender.
Yeah.
I was seen as...
You knew the ghost sort of thing. You knew what's going on. Yeah.
Tougher, knew the ropes. So sent back to Reby. And again, same thing, could be very, very good or very, very bad, but was losing the plot. And back then... we always had male superintendents, deputy superintendents. And that's how I wound up at Kambala.
Where is Kambala?
Kambala was the new name for the buildings that had been Parramatta Girls' Home. So what happened, I was put on Mallorol at Reby. For literally nothing, I was giggling in my bed. And the officer asked me to stand out, and I said no. So the deputy superintendent comes. So here's this man coming to my bed, and I leapt out and threw the bedhead at his head. Mm. And, I wasn't charged with assault because he deflected it, but I was put on Mallorol.
Is that like Clark Actor?
I don't know. I've often, it's a heavy, actually Mallorol is given to people with schizophrenia. It's a heavy tranquilizer, and girls who misbehave were given Mallorol. So Cheek and officer have mental health problems. like Actil was given to girls when they were going from Parramatta to Hay to drug them for the trip.
Yeah, well, they used to give it to us just to keep us calm, and you'd sit there like, you know, your brain was working, but your body's like this, and you're just dribbling out the side of your mouth, or they sit around like you know, vegetables, basically. It was
so Mallorol, I hated it. I used to, some of the girls loved being stoned, not me. So I used to spit it in another girl's mouth and pretend I was kissing her. I was top of the typing class and suddenly I couldn't type and I thought, bugger this. So never much of a drug user. Maybe a bit of recreational in my 20s.
Bless ya.
So I wasn't conforming, but they didn't know that. And then one day, it was really bizarre. Things, I was in the trampoline queue. It was sports day. I can remember, and the officer called me out just as it was about my turn, and took me to the dorm and was saying weird things that I was lucky and thanks to these bra burners. And I didn't know what a bra burner was, except that I'd burnt my bra.
Yeah.
So I couldn't figure out. I thought, she's gone insane. This officer's gone troppo. What the hell is she talking about? I didn't know I was going to Kambala or that Kambala existed. So anyway, she told me to pack my bags. Pack your bags. I said, I don't want to move dorms. You're leaving. And in my head, I thought they were going to let me out. Somehow they'd found, I don't know how, so, you know, distortion. Hello.
Sorry, pack. She's just snuck into the studio. Forgive me. Crystal, get out.
Patty.
Shut the door.
Patty, who's not impressed at being disturbed.
Oh, dear. Forgive me for that.
Yeah. So a strange, unreal, really strange, bizarre things happen. So I'm packing my bags. She said, I'm leaving. I'm going, where am I going to? Because I knew Parramatta Girls Home had closed. No girls were coming in. So I thought they were sending me to Hay. I didn't realise it had closed. So I started to jack up. And that's when she said, no, Hay's closed. But throwing the bedhead at the superintendent, deputy, you would have been there. If Hay was open, you would have been there.
She so said, how old, Sandy, were you right at this present time?
15.
Okay. 15. Now, why I ask is because I've heard stories of both men and women back then being put into adult jails, you know, a lot younger than 18.
No. Oh, gosh, no, I was 15. So yep. And serving a sentence for being an uncontrollable child. So, and no, yeah, he deflected. Anyway, I said, where's Kambala? And she only told me where I was going because I was jacking up thinking I was going to Hay. And she said, oh, it's a new name for Parramatta Girls Home. You're very lucky. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, I'm not lucky. Girls get bashful fingers. What the hell is it? She said, oh, no, thanks to those feminists, you know, you're the first girl who's going to camp. And I'm like, feminist? Bra burning?
Wow.
Parramatta's. So what happened is on the way, I got dropped off at Glebe Shelter because the minister hadn't signed my papers.
Was that the one near Bajura? Bajura Children's Court?
Yeah, okay. It doesn't exist anymore.
No, it doesn't, but I'm familiar. I've spent plenty of time in Bajura Children's Court, and I think by memory, that was still existing in the late 80s, early 90s, or it was closed but present.
Yeah, I'm not sure. See, I didn't know. Oh, excuse me.
No, you're right.
I didn't know Sydney. I'd only spent 2 years out at Windsor as a kid.
Yeah.
So literally they could have been taking me anywhere. I didn't know one suburb. So I thought we'd arrived at Parramatta Girls Home, but Glebe Shelter. I've always had psychic dreams. I've had them about inmates in the adult prison. I've had them always through my life. I have these, they're like premonitions, but they don't unfold exactly. But I've had weird dreams about people I've never met who come into my life and cause absolute havoc, sometimes Shit. Years later. Or sometimes I meet them and have the dream. But
well, I hope you have a good dream about me after our chat.
No. It's going to happen already. No.
Oh, well, so, it would have been a pre-dream.
Yeah. So, yeah. So I'm just overnight, I'm taken into Glebe shelter.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to say the girl's name, but this officer came up to me and said, oh, my goodness, I thought you were this other girl. And I'm looking at her and I thought, that's really strange, because I knew, you know, the young girl she was talking about had murdered someone.
Yep.
So I remember years earlier when I was about 12, somehow I'd seen it paper or telly and I'd had a nightmare about it as a young girl. And Mum had to bring me out of the nightmare. And in this nightmare, I didn't look anything like her, but we were Siamese twins. In this nightmare, I was this girl's twin. And Mum just thought I shouldn't be watching a TV or reading horror stories in the paper, which I never did. So this officer's going, wow, I thought you were her. And I went, oh, my God, am I, you know, I said, I'm going to Kambala. And she said, oh, she's there. You'll really like her. And I thought, what is going on today? That you've got bra burners, you've got officers feminists with nice murders. Yeah, so it was a really screwy, screwy day. And then I arrive at Kambala, which no one knew existed at the time, no girls. And it was these creepy old buildings and you could feel the sorrow ooze off them. It was creepy, it was brand new. Kambala, you could just feel this history there, all this tragedy.
For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. That's right. For the record, you ain't trying to grow any stunt for you. That's right. For the record, lab on me going all the way. All the way. For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste. Stop calling. For the record, for the record, yeah. For the record.